Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi there, and welcome once again to the Explaining History podcast. Thanks for tuning in on Monday, and we've got a really good week of content ready for you to go out. A couple of reviews and some diving into some deep topic areas that we're going to do. And the one I want to start with today is the idea of Europe's generational period of self-destruction from 1914 to 1945. And I'm looking at Ian Kershaw's book, To Hell and Back, which is an interesting departure for Ian Kershaw, who, as we know, is one of the leading historians of Nazi Germany, probably the most celebrated biographer of Adolf Hitler. And he's looking at a kind of a more pan-European approach here. And I really enjoyed reading the way in which he kind of sums up the deep structural causes of this kind of genocidal period of European history, and the various economic, ideological, and structural factors that lead to it. So that's what I'll talk about this morning. There's a marvelous quote to begin the book by Churchill in 1901, where he says, "The wars of people will be more terrible than those of kings." And there's something very, very kind of pertinent to that, in that the 20th century is widely referred to as the people's century. It's an age where mass populations were connected with political power through the franchise, through mass political organisations and mass mobilisation, in a way that they hadn't been at any other point in history. And the result was political change on a scale unprecedented. You only need to look at examples such as the Russian Revolution, the development of Nazism and Italian fascism, but also political movements such as the Popular Fronts in Spain and France, and mass labour politics and mass democracy in Great Britain, to realise this was a people's century. The kings and emperors were only peripheral figures when it came to deciding the politics of war and peace. Now, perhaps the more in-depth text that you'd get if you were wanting to explore this would be Eric Hobsbawm's The Age of Extremes, his history of what he calls the short 20th century, that he argues ran from 1914 to 1991. But in The Age of Extremes, Hobsbawm refers to Europe as having been a civilization, the civilization of 19th century Europe, that is completely shattered and destroyed by the events of 1914, and unable to recreate itself after 1918. Instead, new political ideas and new political forces, along with the economic forces of debt, particularly, and inflation, have reshaped the world so that it would have been unrecognisable to the Edwardians who had bid it farewell 4 years earlier. So Kershaw presents a solid thesis. He says that there were four main factors that made it a Second World War orbit inevitable, impossible to secure stability across Europe after the Paris Peace Conference in 1919. And he said these were an explosion of ethnic racist nationalism, and that's not just contained to Nazi Germany, as we'll look at in a moment, bitter and irreconcilable demands for territorial revisionism, acute class conflict, now given concrete focus through the Bolshevik Russian Revolution, and a protracted crisis of capitalism, which many observers thought was terminal. So we'll look at each one of these points in turn. But together they present a crisis of almost inestimable proportions. One of the great surprises of the 20th century is that liberal democracy, in one form or another, survived. By 1941-42, it looked increasingly unlikely that that was going to happen. So, an explosion of ethnic racist nationalism. The destruction of four empires, three of which were mainly multi-ethnic, the Russian, Ottoman and Austrian, and the fourth, the German Empire, which was indeed multi-ethnic. It contained French people in Alsace and Lorraine, Poles in Prussia, Silesia. There were Czechs and other ethnic minorities along the south-eastern border. But not to the same extent that, say, Austria-Hungary was multi-ethnic or the Ottoman Empire. But the collapse of these empires, mainly in 1918, led to the realisation of ambitions from as far away as Ukraine to Iraq and Syria that would be irreconcilable with reality. In Sleepwalkers by Christopher Clarke, one of the things that he notes is as Serbia became more autonomous from the Ottoman Empire from 1878 onwards, the increasing strength of nationalist culture in Serbia is totally overwhelming to any institutions of moderation in Serbian society. And the kind of the irredentism, the desire for territories that have long been seen as ethnically Serbian, that have in sort of Serbian mythology been unfairly annexed away by the Austrians or whomsoever else, is a huge and sort of corrosive part of Serbian cultural life. Now, if you imagine, if you fast forward to 1919, and there was irredentism in the new Czechoslovakian state, Poland, Hungary, Romania, Ukraine, as that was briefly liberated and then re-assimilated back into the Soviet Union. There was irredentism across the Ottoman Empire. And you find that in the Balkans and in other parts of Europe, there is very little ethnic homogeneity. There are patchworks of communities all the way across the Balkans and Eastern Europe where different ethnic groups have lived cheek by jowl for centuries, getting on and not getting on in turn, but living some kind of fairly ordered and stable existence in the knowledge that there was always an authority in the guise of Austrians or Turks or whoever willing to impose law and order if it got out of hand. if intercommunal tensions turn into violence. But it's the imposition of borders and the development of new ideas of national identity, i.e. on that side of the border you are Hungarian, on this side of the border you are Polish. And therefore, if you exist on this side of the border and you are Polish, why is it you are currently speaking a different ethnic language, Ukrainian or whatever? The creation of nation states actually fuels notions of ethnic tribalism, and each new nationalism functions in roughly the same way that most nationalisms do. If you want a really good read on that one, please read Imagine Communities by Benedict Anderson. It's the best and most brilliant analysis of nationalism I think it's probably never been written. But nationalisms have to reach into the past in order to explain the present and to predict the glorious future round the corner. Nationalism is a very modern idea, but it has an imagined past that it draws from, which is normally wholly incompatible with those of its neighbours. The second point was bitter and irreconcilable demands for territorial revisionism. The decisions about what to do with the collapsed empires of Europe and the Middle East was incredibly complicated. There were map-drawing teams at the Paris Peace Conference revising their planned maps on a daily and sometimes on an hourly basis. They had often little contact with one another and were loosely supervised by the overstretched administrations of Britain and France. So you had British and French diplomatic officials carving up parts of Eastern Europe and the Middle East that they had very little understanding with and certainly would never have visited. And this meant that the combined with Woodrow Wilson's pronouncements on self-determination for all peoples, you had an explosive and powerful mix of forces here. When Wilson made a statement saying that all peoples should have self-determination, in effect he was saying that all ethnic groups should be able to exist in homogeneous nation states. That's how it's heard. Interestingly, his pronouncements on self-determination don't quite extend as far as Britain and France's colonies around the world. The British and French make sure that their empires and their imperial interests are not affected. And if anything, their empires actually grow following the Paris Peace Conference. But the telling a patchwork continent of ethnic groupings like Europe, particularly in Eastern Europe, that ethnic homogeneity was the preferred outcome and that all peoples having self-determination were able to live under one flag together was presenting Europe really with kind of wholly unrealistic expectations of what could be achieved. Invariably, you wind up again with multi-ethnic states, Czechoslovakia being a point in question. The new Yugoslav state was a coalition of Croat, Serb and Slovene peoples. The Poles and the Hungarians lived with ethnic minorities in their borders. And one of Hitler's main complaints is that self-determination seems to apply to everybody else except for Germans who would be condemned to live, in his view, under the rule of inferior Slavic peoples, such as the Sudeten Germans in Czechoslovakia. He also said, surely Anschluss, the Austrians, they are a Germanic people. The forbidding of Anschluss means that there can be no union between Germany and Austria. this is a direct contravention of the Wilson's 14 points, and so the Treaty of Versailles does not apply to Germans. And Hitler's ability to point out the shortcomings and the problems and what he viewed as the hypocrisies of the Treaty of Versailles goes a long way to undermining it. And not just undermining it in the eyes of Germans, but within a decade or so, many members of the British government, particularly the British Foreign Office, are starting to look at the Treaty of Versailles and think, well, this was pretty unreasonable, and as a result we've stored up all sorts of problems for the future. One of the earliest examples of these contested demands for territorial revisionism.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Were the compromises that were made at Italy's expense at the Paris Peace Conference. The furious exit from the Big Five group, of Italy, which eventually descends to the Big Three once Japanese delegation abandoned it as well. It was based around the refusal of the Allies to grant Italy the Dalmatian coastline, which would now be in modern-day Croatia, and the port of Fiume, which was granted to Yugoslavia, which had a large Italian population and had traditionally been seen as Italian. Other demands of Austrian Alpine territory are partially granted, but really most of what Italy wanted is no longer on the table. There was a hope that Italy might be given large portions of the Ottoman Empire as well, and this fades to nothing. And the contrast with Germany is interesting. Germany, as the vanquished power, has to accept what it views as all manner of unfair provisions at the Treaty of Versailles, whereas the Italians, as one of the victorious powers, but in the eyes of the British and French, seen as a kind of a negligible also-ran that switched sides to get a better deal when it suited them. And much of that observation isn't actually completely fair. I mean, the Italian war effort was plagued with disaster, but actually large numbers of Italians were sacrificed in order for the final victory. And the Italians, whilst perhaps not being the most skillfully led of armies, if you look at the tremendous sacrifices after at the Battle of Caporetto, still, the levels of kind of military competence on the Italian side are in some ways roughly comparable to the various disasters inflicted on British troops at battles such as the Somme and the various battles of Passchendaele, of Ypres. All the victorious powers were riven by deep class conflict by 1919. During the Paris Peace Conference, Louis George had to return home to deal with the levels of militancy and unrest, which went from not simply just the wartime workers and miners, but also the police force in Great Britain. One of the reasons why the British have a police federation, essentially a trade union for the police, is because of unrest in 1919 and 1920, where the police essentially threatened to go on strike. mutinies within the army of soldiers demanding to be returned home. There were much bigger mutinies in the French army in 1917. Obviously, mutinies in Russian army in February 1917 lead to the February Revolution. And later, it's the army choosing for the Bolsheviks has a significant impact on the October Revolution. So class militancy, class conflict, was not contained to Russia alone. The previous podcast I'd done on Great Britain from last week somewhere, I talked about union militancy during the Forgotten Depression of the early 1920s. That's well worth a listen if you're doing something on this topic area. But it's important to remember, of course, that World War One really ends primarily because of class struggle in Germany. The Kaiser of Germany abdicates because there is a revolution. It is the German army is being defeated on the battlefield. But had Germany remained socially stable, the chances are that the Allies would have reached the German border and then dug in for an extremely long fight. They would no doubt have planned to have invaded Germany, but the German army and probably the German population would have fought for every inch of territory. So the overthrow of the Kaiser was pretty sure that he was going to go the way of his cousin Nicholas II, who had been gunned down earlier that year, and he fled to the Netherlands. The reason why the Treaty of Versailles signed in the way that it was, why a reluctant and resentful delegation from the Weimar government, led by Philipp Scheidemann, who signed the Treaty of Versailles when they did, instead of holding out and prevaricating, is that they knew that if any more pressure was brought to bear on Germany from the large British blockade or from an Allied invasion on Germany, that quite possibly a second revolution would happen. And the communists or the Spartacists may seize power, just as a second revolution had happened in Russia. The moderate social democrats of the SPD were acutely aware that they would be essentially first up against the wall if that happened. So the being able to conclude business with the Allies and then quickly make a deal with the army to shore up the state. Already in January of that year, the army, January 1919, the army had been used to put down the Spartacists, but the threat of the radical left had not gone away by any stretch of the imagination in Germany. Class conflict lingers, of course, because the civil war in the Soviet in Russia doesn't see the overthrow of the communist regime. Instead, the Soviet Union is established, and it is a pariah state. John Maynard Keynes makes the point in his book in 1920, The Economic Consequences of the Peace, that nothing is done to bring Russia back into the world economic system or the world political system. It's a pariah state that exists on the periphery of Europe and is exists in a state of chaos to some part, but as a dictatorship emerges, becomes a destabilising factor, particularly from the 1930s onwards, as it develops its own new industries designed to really defend the Soviet Union and be able to project the Soviet Union's military might overseas. And throughout this time, communist parties that exist across Europe, and America and Asia and pretty much everywhere else, following the purge of Trotsky, look to Stalin, and via the tool of Comintern, the organisation of Comintern, look to Stalin for their political direction. Stalinist orthodoxy therefore manages to infiltrate everyday life in European countries and other countries across the world. Throughout the 1930s, you see periodic outpourings of class conflict, not so much in Britain. Britain's had its moment with the general strike. The hunger marches throughout the 1930s, and later the decision by British volunteers, about 2,500 of them, to go to Spain and fight, shows that issues and questions of class struggle and a very politicised working class were key in shaping the ideas of the age. There was an immense amount of sympathy. I've talked about this quite a lot before, the fellow traveller movement. There's an immense amount of intellectual sympathy for the Soviet Union throughout the period. Everyone from Sidney and Beatrice Webb through to H.G. Wells, George Bernard Shaw, and a host of other sympathetic intellectuals who weren't actually members of the Communist Party themselves, but they really wanted communism to triumph in Russia, whilst being blind to the purges and famines. They offered communism immense intellectual support and respectability. And as a result, the Nazi-Soviet Pact of August 1939 is quite a shock to them. And one of the reasons why the Soviet Union is fated throughout the 1930s is it seems to be the only country that is capable of developing economically at the height of the Great Depression. The idea that market forces were a modern and innovative and powerful and useful tool to shape economies and competitiveness and efficiency was an absolute anachronism after the First World War. The old order based on free markets, small government, and what we would think of as economic liberalism had been destroyed by the war. The First World War showed that state intervention clearly worked. State intervention could mobilise the entire nation for victory. And so there was a belief that, well, if that's possible, why can we not use state intervention to mobilise the entire nation for peace? And Lloyd George, in his various housing acts, planned in the early 1920s, speaks in these terms. The intellectuals such as the Webbs viewed the reliance on market forces as a real kind of backward step. The kind of thing that might have been okay in the 19th century, but obviously that resulted in slums and inequality, and a modern, scientifically informed, technocratic state that could plan logically and orderly would be the way of doing things in the 20th century. This is a real kind of modernist fantasy. And by the way, when I say fantasy, I'm not suggesting that it's impossible, but it was a modernist vision. I think that's perhaps the kind of the way of looking at it. And this vision seems to be realising itself in the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union economically is speaking their language and seeming to be successful, if you ignore the gulags and the famines. And in the Western world, the beginning of the Great Depression in October 1929, with the Wall Street crash, simply underlines to anyone unsure that the capitalist system is anarchy. It can't be relied on to produce material and beneficial outcomes for most of the population. And there's no easy way to reconcile this chaos before the war. Britain's Great Depression lasts comparatively shorter time than the United States. Britain's abandonment of the gold standard enabled the country to devalue and come out of depression by about 1934 or 35 at the latest. And then house building in the second part of the 1930s enabled a relatively prosperous south and middle of the country to develop. Of course, the thing about the Great Depression in Britain is it's always regionalised. You know, the South East and the Midlands do pretty well, whereas economic backwaters that are previously based on heavy industry, such as Wales, Scotland, Northern Ireland and the north of England, are forgotten. So that brings in the collision of those four factors. The rise of ethnic and racial nationalism, irredentism and the desire for the revision of the Treaty of Versailles, the explosion in class conflict, and the inability to, after 1929, to resurrect the world economy, meant that crisis in whatever combination was all but inevitable. Anyway, I've gone on for way too long on this podcast, but I hope you've enjoyed it and you found it handy. Now, if you can go to the Explaining History iTunes page and give us a vote, give us a thumbs up, give us a thanks, because it all really, really helps. That would be really handy, and I'll catch you on the next podcast coming soon. All the best. Bye-bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.